Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This weekend on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, an absolutely amazing and riveting documentary series is going to be airing, a three-part documentary airing on the flagship program American Experience. It is called The Great War. And this program is airing to commemorate the 100th anniversary of America's entrance, official entrance, into the First World War. And it is an opportunity for us to look back at this world-altering conflict, a war waged like no war before it had ever been waged. And it says much about the state of the world that such a conflict could spring into being, and that it could be such a horrific conflict with such terrible loss of life on both sides. A war that was fought in a system of entrenchment that only escalated the amount of carnage that it exacted. And the pain lives on to this very day in ways that most of us do not begin to fully understand and comprehend. The film is beautifully constructed. And among the many experts who are on hand to lend their own perspectives is a historian and author with a very local connection, namely Robert John Laplander, who now makes his home in Waterford, Wisconsin. He has been a historian for many, many years, and particularly examined certain important moments in the First World War, and is perhaps best known for a stunning book called Finding the Lost Battalion, Beyond the Rumors, Myths, and Legends of America's Famous World War I Epic. This involves the long, protracted, and ultimately horrific battle which occurred in the Argonne Forest in the fall of 1918. This was a turning point in this bloody conflict. But we will talk about other matters as well. Again, related to the film in three parts airing this weekend on PBS called The Great War. Robert Laplander, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Could you, first of all, explain what, if anything in particular, has prompted your lifelong interest in the Second World War and caused you to devote so much time and energy to understanding this conflict better?
The First World War pretty much shaped the way we live. Everything that happened in the 20th century after it happened because of it. And many of the problems that we deal with today, and as well as many of the successes that we deal with today, you can trace directly to what happened during and after the conflict between 1914 and 1918. The direct outcome of the First World War was the Second World War. And because of the Second World War, many, many things changed, not just in America, but of course in Europe. And we can trace all of this back to what happened between 1914 and 1918. America became a true superpower between 1918 and 1920. We wouldn't realize that for another 20 years. And we wouldn't really face up to it, but we did become the superpower that we were destined to be, and we learned a lot about ourselves as a people and as a nation at that time.
One of the points that's made very early in the film, The Great War, is that at the time that this conflict began, the United States had a population of roughly 100 million people. I think they say it has made us the second most populous nation in the world. And one third of our population, one third of the people who lived here were either themselves immigrants or the children of immigrants. And I think a lot of us sort of know that, but I don't think a lot of us maybe stop to realize what that meant when this terrible conflict erupted in Europe, what that would mean for Americans who were Italian-Americans or German-Americans or whatever they happened to be, that had a whole lot to do with why this was, in a sense, such an especially turbulent time for our country, even before we actually entered this conflict.
There was considerable controversy as to whether we should get in or not, for a variety of reasons, but mostly because America traditionally and legally just never meddled in anything having to do with European wars. The other part about it that really stirred the public was the fact that if you were an immigrant and you lived here, you didn't have to be a citizen of the United States to be drafted. When they enacted the draft laws and they started bringing people into the Army because they knew that the only way they were going to be able to raise an army big enough to fight in Europe was through a draft. At the beginning of the war, when we got in April of 17, our Army, National Guard, and Marine Corps only stood at 250,000. We ranked 17th in the world. It was a drop in the bucket. The Germans had 3 million men in the field at the time. So in order to raise the amount of people that we were going to need, they enacted a draft. And part of that draft law said if you lived here, it didn't matter if you were an immigrant or not, you would serve. And a lot of the immigrants had come to America to escape what was a common theme in European life. Almost all countries in Europe had enacted national service. You turned 18, you gave 2 years to the state, and that's all there was to it. And then you remained in the reserves for the rest of your life. A lot of people didn't want to do that, so they came here because they knew they could get away from that. Others, like particularly in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Ohio, where they had large German populations, didn't want to get in the war and risk fighting people in their own family or fighting against their homeland. And it was a very understandable thing at the time. And it caused a lot of controversy, particularly in Wisconsin. A few people realized that the incidents in Wisconsin of sabotage and anti-war sentiment were higher than almost any other state in the Union at the time.
Another point which is made in the film is the fact that when America ultimately does enter the conflict, we are not entering it for the sake of our own survival. We were not entering it because we had been directly attacked or threatened with direct attack. And so, in a sense, it's not maybe the best term to use, but in a sense, we were entering this war for more philosophical reasons or political reasons, and that made the whole matter of galvanizing the population behind the war effort all the more important. And of course, the film takes great lengths to explain all of the ways in which the propaganda machine was turned to a fever pitch in order to inspire the masses to want to be enthusiastic about joining in this terrible conflict.
Well, they did have to sell the war. This was the very first time that we were going to be involved in an overseas conflict. For the very first time, we were going to fight a coalition war. It was a war of firsts, and we were going to send a major expeditionary force to fight on a foreign shore, not for land, not for riches, not for any of that, not for power, but for an ideal that we held dear at home that was being threatened in France, who had helped us attain the ideal here during our revolution. And there was a sense of history that really appealed to the American public. Nobody wanted war. Wilson was elected to a second term because he kept us out of the war. And it, by and large, was the way America believed. At the same time, there were many who knew in their heart that there was no way we would be able to stay out of it. When we got into it, when the decision was finally made that there was no way that we could we could stay out of it, the American public began to rally. The Committee for Public Information really did crank up a propaganda machine that worked exceptionally well. And it really rallied the people around the flag and around the boys and sent them over there and bring them back home and everything. But at the same time, it also raised a lot of questions and caused a lot of issues, particularly for people who dissented, who were not fully behind the war. If you were not fully behind the war, you were looked at as being un-American. We learned a lot about supporting our troops and stuff between Vietnam and the first Iraq war. When they came home from Vietnam and we were, you know, the American public was spitting on soldiers and blaming them. And then when first Iraq came around, the American public began to understand you can hate the war, but you can't hate the soldier for what they're doing. They're just doing their job. During the First World War, nobody hated the soldiers, but there were plenty of people who were dissenting here at home. If you didn't believe in the war, you were anti-American. You were on the wrong side. You were looked at as being not fully American and not on board with this whole thing. And then that made you the enemy. We really came to understand what propaganda could do, and us as a people really began to understand ourselves. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the First World War was kind of lost to history after the war, is because people didn't want to talk about it anymore. A large section of the American public felt that they had been betrayed, felt that they had been duped by the United States government. The doughboys came home, they watched the peace conferences happen, they watched what happened in the 20s. You know, they signed the final peace in 1922. By 1923, Hitler was already banging the drum. By 1925, a lot of the doughboys were standing up going, what did we go over there for? And by 1939, 1940, it was very apparent that what we had done as the Allies, as a world power, between 1914 and 1918, hadn't done any good at all. It had just put off for 21 years what was inevitably going to happen. And it had, in large measure at the peace table, spawned that Second World War.
Right.
So there was a serious backlash through the 20s and into the 30s by the American public, particularly, that they just didn't want to hear about it anymore. So it kind of got swept under the carpet. When the government started to query some of the doughboys in the 1970s about their experiences, they were pretty reticent and really didn't want to talk to the government about what had happened. Now we have the Veterans History Project, where we strive to collect the stories from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam. The World War I guys didn't want to have anything to do with it, by and large.
One thing that was intriguing to me in watching the film, again, we're talking about the American Experience, three-part documentary called The Great War, is the fact that in the minds of many, particularly in retrospect, looking at how this war began in the first place, even before the United States had entered it, that it was, in some respects, a stupid, foolish war. At one point, somebody in the film talks about Europe blundering into this bloody conflict. Can you just say a word about the circumstances that allowed this war to begin in the first place, and to what extent that is a fair characterization to call it? Some people would probably say most wars in some respect are foolish, but that this was an especially foolish war, blundered into for really no good reason.
It really is. When you look at the historiography of the war, what happened in 1914, did the murder of one low-level monarchy, member of a monarchy, warrant 13 million lives over the course of 4 years and 4 months? It's not like the Second World War. The Second World War, there were clear good guys and bad guys. The Nazis were the bad guys. The Japanese were the bad guys. They had to be defeated, and that's all there was to it. In the First World War, it was different. you can trace the roots of the aggressions back to the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1871. France and remained implacably hostile towards Germany after that. There was going to be no peace, no friendship between the two. That's all there was to it. Prussia and Germany had fought in 1866. They had just only recently made up their differences and decided to join forces. The Austro-Hungarians were part of that as well. There was all kinds of intrigue and infighting in Europe for many, many years before the First World War, which led to the mutual protection treaties that had been signed between what became the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary, and the Allied Powers, France and Britain and Belgium and Russia. And it's important to remember that at that time, in that place, the weapons technology had outstripped communications. So it was extremely important that if you were provoked and you had decided that you were going to war as a country, you had to enact your war plan, and it had to be done immediately, and it could not be reversed, because if you tipped your hand to your enemy could get the jump on you. Whoever brought their arms to bear first would likely win a war simply because of the weight of fire that was available to them at that time. John Keegan puts it excellently in his book, The First World War, that two divisions on opposite sides set in front of each other and told to just let go could destroy each other mutually in a few minutes. So it was important that your country got the drop on everybody else. And the most aggressive of the countries in Europe at that time, because they were the youngest, the most virile, and the one that had the least reach around the globe, was Germany. They felt they had something to prove. And when it came time, when they felt it was time to move, and they enacted their war plan known as the Schlieffen Plan, they did so, and there was no turning back. At any time between the murders in Sarajevo and the opening of hostilities right at the end of July 1914, if there had been proper communication, if there had been some sort of National Security Council, if there could have been some sort of a sit-down with everybody in one spot, they could have talked the differences away. The First World War did not need to happen. There was no clear-cut reason for a war of that scale to first break out, then escalate, and then continue. Because even after the first abortive clash of arms in 1914, when the Germans were stopped at the Marne, there could have been a turnaround right there. They could have all sat down and said, look, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, let's stop and talk this out. But they didn't. They persisted. It was almost as if it was a machine and there was no way to turn it off.
Once these wheels were set in motion.
Yeah, once these wheels were set in motion, it's almost like they could not turn it off. And if they could not, they obviously would not.
Right.
And that's what led to the shatter of the trench lines, which descended on Europe at the end of 1914, and a trench line system that stretched for 480 miles and barely moved 20 miles in either direction for the next 4 years.
Right. Before we go on, I want to reintroduce you. For those of you just joining us, we are previewing a superb three-part documentary that airs this weekend on the PBS series American Experience. It's called The Great War. That is how once upon a time everyone thought of what we now call the First World War, a horrific conflict in so many respects. And historian Robert Laplander, who makes his home now in Waterford, is one of the experts who has a presence in this film. And so we are talking about the onset of the conflict, and very soon we'll be talking about America's entrance and ultimately a crucial battle in which Robert Laplander is one of the world's leading authorities. You just made mention of what, of course, became a dramatically different way of waging war in this matter of entrenchment. And, of course, a lot of people can imagine in their minds what they have seen in various films, these deep and long trenches, but I think most of us have no idea of just how lengthy and intricate this system of trenches was and what a revolution they represented. Am I correct that the world had never really seen anything like this in terms of a war being fought to such a large extent in these trenches? How did such a thing come about?
The first time that the trenches were really used was in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. And both sides learned quite a bit about entrenchment, about digging in. And at one point in history, it had been fortification. And fortification had been the thing. Both France and Belgium were surrounded by a girdle of forts along their border with Germany. And these forts did a lot to protect the borders. It was almost like the Maginot Line of World War II. When Hitler bypassed the Maginot Line in World War II, the Schlieffen Plan of World War I was intended to do the same thing with the French forts on the frontier, which is why Germany went through Belgium. And they were able to destroy the Belgian forts relatively quickly. Trench lines are something different. Trench lines, for all the weight of firepower that can be thrown against the trench line, it's much more difficult to completely destroy a hole in the ground by making another hole in the ground. It's very easy to incorporate multiple shell holes into an interconnected trench line again. So when they settled down into the siege warfare, which is essentially what it was, and they began to build the lines in duplicate and triplicate and connecting them with communication trenches, stringing barbed wire in between the trench systems, in between the opposing trench systems, and they sat there and just blasted away each other. At one point in 1916 and 1917, the British were losing 2,000 men a day, killed and wounded, just holding the line. It was a war of attrition to sit in these trench lines. When we got into the war, the first thing that our commander, General Pershing, had done when he went to France in June of 1917 is he took a tour of the Western Front, saw what the British and the French had been doing for 3.5 years, and went, okay, that's not what we're going to do. It needs to be a war of movement in order to be won. That's not to say that the French and British hadn't tried. Of course they had. Each year of the war brought another attack, another major attack. But these attacks resulted in largely nothing more than tremendous amounts of casualties. July 1st, 1916, on the Somme, is the bloodiest day in British military history. They lost 60,000 men in the first day, 40,000 in the first 2 hours, and 20,000 of that total were killed outright. And that battle had 6 more months to run.
Mm.
So these are the kind of casualties that we're talking about. This is what the war produced. Before the war, battles were measured in days. After the war, they were measured in months.
Mm.
Before the war, casualties were measured in the thousands or the hundreds of thousands. After the war, they were measured in millions. Mm. These were staggering numbers that were very devastating to the countries that were involved. America was determined to not suffer those amounts of casualties. Unfortunately, and it's a very American thing to believe that we're going to do it better, that we can do it better. And we believed we had the key. Our commanders believed they had the key to breaking the stalemate on the Western Front. It was slightly unrealistic, and it would have worked better had we had more of a time frame. But in a year, we went from having a standing army of 250,000 to having 4.6 million men in uniform and 2 million of them overseas. That's staggering. That's a staggering amount. And it's an increase, an exponential increase that just beggars the imagination.
Right. We can hardly comprehend such a thing. We should step back
for just getting started.
Right. Right. We should step back for a moment and talk about the conditions that first kept us out of this war and that ultimately led us into it. And I appreciate that the documentary spends as much time as it does talking about President Woodrow Wilson, who has to be among the most intriguing stories in the history of American presidents. One point made in the documentary that I don't ever remember being made any place else, although I'm sure somebody has made this observation at some point, is that Woodrow Wilson has the distinction of being the only U.S. president ever born in a country that lost a war, and that was namely the Confederacy. He was from the South, and so he was born, in a sense, in a country that had lost a war. And the documentary suggests that this deeply informed President Wilson's attitudes about war as something that should be avoided at all costs.
As a boy, he had watched Confederate soldiers come home, and there's a defeat that is part of being a Southerner that we as Northerners don't understand and can't understand. It has become part of the fabric of life. It's a sense of loss more than anything else, and I think Wilson felt this to a great degree since he was touched by it firsthand. And it really instilled in him a real distaste for war, which is always a good thing. War is never something that people want. Unfortunately, it's sometimes necessary, but it's never anything that people really want unless you're completely whacked. So Wilson was not the kind of guy who wanted to see us go to war. He did everything he could to keep us out, but he admitted on the night that he had asked Congress to declare war, he admitted to one of his aides that he had seen the futility of neutrality right from the beginning. He knew that there was going to be little that we were going to be able to do to stay out of that war, but he had to try. He owed it to his morals, he owed it to his country, and he owed it to his office to do everything that he could to keep us out of a war that pretty much wasn't our business. It became our business when Germany made it our business by resuming unrestricted submarine warfare. In the beginning of the war, we traded with everybody. We traded with the French, we traded with the British, we traded with the Germans. It didn't matter. We weren't part of that war. It was just business. The British blockaded the German ports, and for us to run that blockade to sell to Germany would have been an act of war. We weren't willing to do that. So we decided, you know what, we'll just not sell to them. We sold to the French and the British simply because we could get to their ports. Unrestricted submarine warfare meant that it didn't matter what flag was flying on the ship or where they were going or what they were hauling, Germany was going to sink them, and that's all there was to it. And we saw that as more of an act of international piracy than anything else, and that's what ultimately drove us into the war. The Zimmerman telegram, there's considerable controversy as to whether the Zimmerman telegram was authentic or not. It had been actually discovered first by the British intelligence agency, and the First Lord of the Admiralty at that time was Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill recognized that there was no way that Britain could win without us in the war and had done everything he could to get us into the war. He did the same thing in World War II. And it's very interesting to see how Churchill had moved behind the scenes in both wars and how similar those movements were. But few people realize that Britain and France had already come up with the notion that they could not proceed with the war beyond 1917. France knew that by December 1917, without American intervention, they were going to be out of artillery shells and they were not going to be able to perpetrate the war beyond Christmas 1917. The British had come to the same conclusion independently, and neither power had told the other, but the British had decided that by November 1917, if there had not been a decision, that they would sue Germany for peace because they could not perpetrate the war forever.
Right.
America coming into the war changed that. And it didn't change it so much on the battlefield. Yes, we went to the battlefield and we really did participate and we really did throw in our men and do our best on the battlefield in the brief time that we were there. What really scared the Germans was the specter of America's gathering millions. Our first draft call in June of 1917, there were 10 million names on the list. We had two more draft calls after that, and we were just getting started. Germany was scraping the bottom of the barrel by 1918 for men and material, and here was this massive power that was shipping over by August of 1918 250,000 troops a month, and the flood was not going to stop. Germany knew that they couldn't win, and the best that they could do was try to put themselves in a decent position at the peace tables. And Wilson, that's where Wilson wanted us to be. He wanted us to be a very high-minded idealist that he was. The 14 points was a wonderful thing that he put together. He wanted us to have an upper hand at the peace tables. He told Pershing, he gave Pershing one order when he sent him to France. He said, you need to win so that we can have a hand at the peace tables.
Right. He wanted us to be, in a sense, in a position of authority as this conflict drew to a conclusion, so we would be in a better position to shape what he hoped would be a lasting peace. What's really interesting is that towards that end, one of his orders to General Pershing is that we were, in a sense, to fight quite independently of the British and French troops who were so desperate for our assistance and were hoping that Americans would be, in a sense, joining them side by side in the trenches. Woodrow Wilson, in a sense, had a vision in which our fighting men would be a distinct force, part of the Allies and yet apart from the Allies. And that probably made for some very tricky decisions to be made about exactly how we would participate in this war.
Pershing's challenges in that direction were incredible. Remember that when General Pershing took over as commander of the American Expeditionary Forces, nobody had ever done this before. There had never been a coalition war that we'd been involved in, so he had to be as much battlefield general as he had to be politician, and there was no roadmap for him to follow. He was creating this as he went along, and this was the roadmap that Eisenhower followed in the Second World War, because now it had been done. So Eisenhower had something to go by. Pershing didn't. And what he was wrestling with continually was the French and the British telling us, look, you don't know how to fight this war. We do. Send over your boys in shirt tails. We will fold them into our battalions. We will put them on the front, and we will fight them. We need manpower. We need men. We need machine guns. We need artillerymen. Send them over. We'll take care of it. Well, that wasn't going to happen because of what Wilson told Pershing and what War Secretary Newton Baker told him as well. We fight as an independent American army. We were not allied with the French and British. We were an associate power. We had no treaties with them whatsoever. If they had pushed us too far, we could have just said, okay, we're going home. We pack up our football and go home. This is your fight anyway. We're just trying to help. Or we would have said, fine, you guys go fight over here. We're going to go fight over here, and we'll see what happens. It's much to Pershing's credit that he held things together as well as he did. The second point about that is that it's illegal for our troops to fight under a foreign flag. American law says, no, you can't do that. And we could not order our men to fight in a foreign army. We can't do that. So the only way that we could fight was as an American independent army, and Pershing fought forever to try to get that to happen against especially the British. The British thought nothing of the American forces. They admired the men. They admired the training that they had. They looked like good troops, but they did not have any faith in our command structure at all. The French did to a certain degree, although the French premier, Clemenceau, never stopped in the entire time we were in France, never stopped trying to get Pershing fired. He did everything he could to try to get Pershing fired so that the French could get their hands on our troops and fight our troops as their own. And Pershing was determined after he made his first tour in June of 1917, he was determined that that was what happened to those European armies was not going to happen to the American army.
Hmm.
On the Aisne in 1917, in April of 1917, the French had lost 40,000 men on the first day of the battle, and the French army went into mutiny after that.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Robert Laplander, a historian who now lives in Waterford, Wisconsin. He is one of the participants in this PBS documentary series airing this weekend called The Great War, looking back at the First World War. Mr. Laplander is very well known for penning a fascinating book called Finding the Lost Battalion, Beyond the Rumors, Myths, and Legends of America's Famous World War I Epic. We should spend the last few minutes of our conversation at least touching on this very important chapter from the First World War and what is called in the film the most famous event of America's part in the war. An attack that was waged in the fall of 1918 in the Argonne Forest. I think it's you who describe the Argonne Forest in such interesting detail. Describe where the Argonne Forest was located and what made it so crucial in this chapter of the war.
The Meuse-Argonne is the biggest and bloodiest battle America has ever fought. In the 47 days that we fought in that sector between the Meuse River and the Argonne Forest, a 22-kilometer sector, we lost an average of 550 men a day for 47 days, KIA, and then times three that wounded, and it makes it the bloodiest battle America's ever been fought, and it also makes it the biggest and bloodiest battle that Americans don't know about. If this was the 1920s or 1930s, you would be more apt to know about it, but after the Second World War came, everything from the first was pretty much forgotten, and one of the worst places to fight in that sector was actually in the Argonne Forest, the Argonne Forest itself. The Argonne Forest itself is one of the largest woodland expanses in Europe, and for centuries, armies have fought around it rather than trying to go through it. It's almost impenetrable to get through it. Having been there and walked through this, it boggles my imagination that anybody could try to fight a war in there. The French and Germans had slugged it out all through 1915 and 1916 in the forest. The Germans had control over about three-quarters of it, and the French finally, after losing 200,000 troops in there, gave up, and the line became static and quiet. The Germans had spent 4 years building up the defenses in there. There's concrete machine gun pillboxes everywhere. There was miles and miles of trenches and miles of barbed wire, sniper nests everywhere. It was a pre-sighted artillery target. The Germans could hit just about anything they wanted anywhere in the forest because they'd been there so long. They could sight everything. And when we went over the top in September of 1918 in this sector, the idea was never to take the Argonne Forest in force because we knew that that was going to be almost impossible. The idea was to pinch it out. A French unit would move up on the left, an American unit would move up on the right, on the outskirts of the forest. The 77th Division would be in the forest, keeping steady and even pressure on what was believed to be a retreating enemy. At the top of the forest, the French and Americans would meet, and the Germans would have no choice but to either evacuate the forest or surrender a tremendous amount of troops. Unfortunately, we believe that the first phase of the Meuse-Argonne offensive would last 72 hours, and it didn't. It took 10 days.
Hmm.
So the fighting was heavier. The defense was heavier. The weather did not cooperate. It started to rain in mid-September, and it didn't stop almost till the end of the war. There were only three roads that fed up to the line in the Meuse-Argonne, and they were both unimproved dirt roads. And everything had to traverse those roads, everything. And so they quickly became jammed with traffic, and there were problems getting supplies up, problems getting the wounded out, problems getting food to the front. Soldiers that went over with, 2 days' rations long ran out of that, casualties were tremendous. And when it became obvious that we were not going to pinch the forest out, that's when the 77th had to start pushing and really pushing into the forest. And the Germans obviously pushed back. Deep in the forest is a narrow ravine that runs east and west. It's called the Charleville Ravine. And the 308th Infantry, which was part of the 77th Division, had orders to attack across that ravine and take a road on the other side. And the units on the right and left of them did not keep up. And when those elements of the 308th Infantry reached the opposite side of the Charleville Ravine, they dug in for the night, believing that their flanks would catch up with them the next day. Instead, the Germans surrounded them that night. And for the next 5 days, the elements of the 308th and 307th Infantry and 306th Machine Gun Battalion that were stuck in there, about 700 men, battled almost continuous attack by the Germans. They lost almost 74% of their troops in 5 days. Some 700 went in, and only 194 were able to walk out under their own power. They faced an artillery barrage by their own men one day, a mistaken artillery barrage. The Germans brought flamethrowers in against them. They had run out of food and medical supplies by noon of the first day. It was probably the most overreported story of the war. They were heroes in the papers at home even before they got out of that ravine. And if this was the 20s or 30s, everybody knew the story of the Lost Battalion.
Right.
It got lost after World War II. So for us to bring the story back, it took a long time, a lot of miles, many trips to France, to understand what happened and to collect bits and pieces of information from everywhere.
Right.
And as the years went by, we began to really see what had happened. And it really is a story that shows what America was at the time. There was a tremendous amount of immigrants, again, in this division. This 77th Division came from New York City. There were replacements that had come from the Midwest that were in there. And it showed the tenacity of the American soldier. And during this event, there were 7 Medals of Honor that were awarded for this event, which would be more than any other event until the raids on the Ploiești de Oia fields in Romania in 1943. It became one of these stories, along with Sam Woodfill and the story of Sergeant York, that really epitomizes what America did in the First World War.
Right. We just have a couple of minutes, but I want you to say a further word about the brave man who led the last battalion, to whom you dedicate your book, Finding the Lost Battalion. What made him what made him such an exceptional leader?
Charles Whittlesey, believe it or not, was from Wisconsin. He was actually born in Florence, Wisconsin.
Hmm.
His family lived here for the first 10 years of his life before they moved out east to Massachusetts, where his father was from. He was a very educated individual. He was a dedicated socialist. He did not believe in war, but he did believe in America. He understood his men. He understood the common man very well. A lot of that had to do with the miners and loggers that he knew growing up in Wisconsin. And then when he got to Massachusetts and he started going to college, he saw the privilege that a lot of the young men around him took for granted. That helped shape who he was. He mentioned one thing in college, that when they asked him what he wanted to do with his life, he said, "I want to do something that I don't want to do." He really wanted to push himself and challenge himself to be something better in life, to really utilize what he had, what had been given to him. In the Army, he was made a paperwork man. He was a paper pusher. In charge of the headquarters company, he only got command of the 1st Battalion, which was a combat unit, because attrition had left him the next in line. He was not a combat commander, but he was determined to do his best. And by and large, he did a better job than just about all the other battalion commanders in the 77th Division. He followed his orders to the letter. They had an opportunity to surrender and with honor and get out of that ravine before there had been so many horrific casualties, but his orders were to stay put. And he understood if he stayed there, the rest of the division would have to catch up with him. Thus, they would break the line. Breaking the line, obtaining the objective, would end the war quicker and would cost fewer lives. The cost to him, however, was tremendous. Here you have a man who needed to be a true leader, never once showed that he was afraid, never once showed that that he had any sort of nerves at all, or that never doubted that they would get out of that ravine, but inside was in unbelievable emotional turmoil. He was not able to express that turmoil to anybody, and after the war, that sort of turned itself into post-traumatic stress disorder, a tremendous case of post-traumatic stress. At the same time, he had been gassed in the summer of 1918, which he had never been treated for. We believe he was suffering from gas-related tuberculosis. After he came home and he was awarded the Medal of Honor, which he understood he was a representative of the unit. They couldn't give it to everybody, so they gave it to him. He didn't necessarily feel that he had deserved the medal, but he understood what it was for. The problem was is they wouldn't leave him alone. He became the first man in the First World War to get it. As such, he was hugely well-known. The story was hugely well-known, and the press never let up on him. The people that he served with would continuously come to him in the post-war economic dip, looking for work, looking for help, looking for advice from their iron commander. The families of those who had been killed came to him, wanting reassurance that their loved one had not suffered. And the sad truth was that people who died in the Argonne Forest rarely died without suffering. But he couldn't tell them that. Adding on top of this, the sickness that he was feeling, eventually it became too much for him. And the Saturday after Thanksgiving in 1921, he had boarded a steamer on his way to Cuba, supposedly for a vacation. And on the way, he leapt off the ship and committed suicide.
It really underscores how the cost of a terrible conflict like the First World War can never be fully calculated. And as I said in the introduction, there are many ways in which the pain of this conflict and the destructiveness of this conflict is still with us to this very day, 100 years after America entered the war. The documentary again airing this weekend is called The Great War, and it's airing as part of the series American Experience. And Robert Laplander's book is Finding the Lost Battalion, Beyond the Rumors, Myths, and Legends of America's Famous World War I Epic. Robert Laplander, a great privilege for me to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise so generously with our Morning Show listeners. I thank you most sincerely.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll have a couple of different interviews, including one with Dr. Mark Keegan, who is an expert on multiple sclerosis and similar disorders. He is on the staff of the Mayo Clinic, where he is a neurologist and a professor of neurology. And we will be talking with him about MS and some of the breakthroughs which have occurred in its treatment. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's 24